Okay, so we got through the first four articles, the big four articles in the B101. Last week we will finish up the remaining 12, or remaining 7 today. As the way the AIA contracts are structured, you'll see this in the A201 when we get there in a couple weeks. They lay out a section for the architect's responsibilities, and then they have a section for the owner's responsibilities, and then there'll be a third section in the A201, which will have the contract responsibilities. So that's where we're going to start in on what are the obligations that the owner has to have when they start out for the projects. As you might suspect, it's significantly less than what the architect has to do, but the owner still is required to provide some information. So, starting off with Article 5.1, the owner shall provide information in a timely manner regarding requirements for information and limitations on the projects. Pretty simple. One of the things that I think I've talked about a little bit in contracts is sometimes the most basic, simple concepts, like, well, of course they got to provide information, but you want to have that in there. You want to make sure that everybody understands what it is. And that way, you can't have a discussion later on where someone says, but that was so simple, so basic, of course you're supposed to provide the information timely. How can you not know that that's a requirement? Well, you could get in a squabble about that. You can get in a fight. Somebody could say, well, what is timely? Or why did you need this? Or you didn't tell me what I had to have. And so you want to write this down. So sometimes things are as simple and black and white as this one is. As an example, so I was on the phone with one of my clients yesterday, and they have they're an owner, and we have a contract on a large project with a construction contractor. They're in the process of building a facility, and in the contract is what's called an incentive clause. And so at certain points during the course of the project, the parties they have five criteria. It's a cost, safety, performance, management, blanking on the fifth one. And there's a set of parameters that are spelled out as to how the contractor can earn a bonus if they have met the certain criteria for the incentives. And that's an exhibit to the contract. So there was a meeting last week of all the principals. There was the senior management of my client, and there was the senior management of the contractor. I wasn't at the meeting, and the contractor showed up with these forms. And he's like, okay, I'm going to pass these forms out. You guys grade us, and then we'll, by the end of the meeting, we'll figure out what our incentive bonus is. Luckily, there was enough people on my client's side to have kind of the understanding to say, wait. We've got to make sure we're following the process. The process was very simple, but we got it. Well, I explained to them yesterday, I go, guys, we can't just do things ad hoc. We got to follow the rules of the contract. And so we have a rule of how you go and figure out the five criteria and how you do that grading. And so just it's as simple as, I always call it the rules of Monopoly, but you want to follow those rules to Monopoly. And so that's the issue here, is that the owner is required to, in a timely manner, to keep the project moving forward, to give whatever requirements or limitations that they have, and they have to provide it a written program and otherwise. So that's the basic gist of that. And you'll see that in all contracts. Well, you'll see that in all AIA contracts. There's a lot of contracts you'll see they won't have this information, but this is something that you want to make sure you do as an owner. And if you're the architect on the other side, and the owner has not given you stuff timely, well, then you can write a letter back and says, I can't move forward. I don't have the information. So if the project's delayed, it's your fault, not mine, effectively. 5.2. So we talked about this last week a little bit about the concept of budget versus cost of the work. And this is, again, outlining. So the owner's required, one of the requirements, and that was from Article 1, the initial information, is they got to establish a budget. And then the owner needs to update that budget if there's changes that the owner agrees to. So you can't have a budget that says, I want a $1 million house. Then they come to you and tell you that it's from a 3-bedroom, 3-bath to a 4-bedroom, 3-bath. The owner still has to recognize that they need to update. So we have an obligation. The owner shall update that budget. And if the owner significantly increases or decreases the budget for the cost of the work, the owner shall notify the architect. So these are things that they have to do and let the architect know, and it requires communication back and forth between the parties. Article 5.3, you got to identify an authorized representative. That's just the point person. And the reason for that is you don't want to have three or four different talking heads for the architect or for the owner. So, for example, in last week's meeting that between my client and the contractor, the two principals that were at the meeting were the owner's reps identified in the contract. So they were able to speak on behalf of the owner and actually bind them to their statements. But if somebody was out in the field, and so we have our project manager, and he's the day-to-day person, but he doesn't have the authority to sign a change order or otherwise. He has certain other authorities. And so he's not necessarily identified in the contract as the contractual authorized representative. So this is something that 5.3 requires. There was in 3.2 maybe, the architect had to provide an authorized representative. So it's the same on either side. 5.4, the owner shall furnish surveys to describe the physical characteristics, legal limitations, etc. So what this is here is, so when the architect comes in, the architect, they may visit the project site and everything else, but they want to make sure that they're designing legally. So if there's a survey, they want to make sure they're not designing over a lot line, or that they're not, that they're designing too close to a lot line. And in fact, some of the obligations that the architect has to do is they have to go in and they have to make sure that they have the, that they're following codes and regulations and laws. And in order for them to do that properly, they have to have the survey information. And since they can't get it, it's the only party that can get it is the owner. So it's the responsibility of the owner to go out and get the surveys. Sometimes the owners may hire a third party to get that information for them, but the owner needs to make sure that they provide that to the architect to have this legal description of the site. The last thing you want to have is an architect design a building, contractor build it, and then the next door neighbor come over and say, you've built on my property. That's something. And if it happens, and the owner has not provided this information, neither the architect nor the contractor are at fault. Okay. 5.5. The owner shall furnish services of geotech engineers. So if you remember back in our basic services for the architect, the architectural services include mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, and structural engineering. It doesn't include civil, and it doesn't include geotech. So geotech, again, if you want to, the way to kind of think about it, if you can, you can think about it in kind of in conjunction, 5.4 and 5.5, geotech is checking what the soil conditions are. Think about those two kind of subsets as together. And they deal with the land, the actual physical property. And so the owner is responsible for getting information about the physical property to the architect. So the architect, when it does its designs, is knowing the four corners of the property, where the building needs to sit, and the structural loads, that's your geotech and soil bearings and those types of things, as to what type of building and how the foundations are supposed to be. So architect provides this certain type of engineering that relates to the building itself. Owner provides information relating to the property. What's not listed here, but it's in this section 4.11, that's that chart I was telling you guys about, is another one is civil engineering. Civil engineering is grades and drainage and those types of things. Again, if you want to think about this in a group, the owner is the one that typically provides the civil engineer. And again, civil engineering relates to the property. So when you divide out services related to the design or the description, the building, the actual structure, electrical, mechanical, structural, that's the architect's side, and the land is the owner's side. 5.6, The owner shall provide supplemental services designated as the owner's responsibility in section 411. So this chart that I talked about, when you guys take a look at the actual B101 document, it's got a long list on the left-hand side of all of the types of services, and then it's got two columns, and one column says architect, and one column says owner. And when the parties start talking about what supplemental services will be necessary for the project, you put a check mark or an X in one of those two columns. And so this says, if there is a X in one of the columns, one of the rows, in 411, that's checked off as owner, this is an obligation, shall provide whatever those supplemental services. So one of them might be civil engineering. You got to provide a civil engineer. Okay? Next, Article 5, Section 5.7. If the owner identified a sustainable objective, the owner needs to fulfill its responsibilities in E204. So if you remember, last week we talked about Article 1.16, and that was this sustainable objective. Does the owner want the building to be green, and do they want that green building to be LEED certified, or Green Globes, or City of Chicago certified, whatever that sustainable objective is. Maybe they don't need it to be LEED certified, but LEED-like. So at my last firm, we did a fairly significant expansion to our conference center. And in the process of doing the design work, the firm wanted it to be a green design, but they didn't want to spend the money for all the paperwork and the filing to get LEED certification for simply a conference center. So we had information, we had language as to our sustainable objective, but it wasn't necessarily a LEED objective. So whatever those are, you put this in article in this separate document, the E204. It's an entirely separate document. You put those as sustainable objectives. And whatever obligations that are identified in there for the owner, they must fulfill those. Just like the architect under Article 3, there was information that said that they need to follow or fulfill their obligations under the sustainable objective as well. So, any questions on this stuff so far? Okay. 5.8. The owner shall coordinate the services of its own consultants with those services provided by the architect. And then they need to provide copies of the scope of services of the contracts and requires consultants to maintain insurance, blah, blah, blah. So what we have here is, the example I've kind of thrown out a few times during our discussions is, let's say you're building a hotel, and the hotel has a restaurant where you've been able to secure the services of a named chef, somebody that won Top Chef or something to that effect. And so you want to highlight your restaurant. So you're going to have your regular architect do the hotel, you bring in a really good architect for that. But for this kitchen, you hire your own separate architect. So you have a contract for the hotel with your architect, and you have a separate contract with your hotel, your kitchen designer. And so that would be their own consultants. And so what this provision says is, it's the owner's obligation to make sure that the kitchen designer's work is coordinated and consulted with the architect. So how does that work? What does that mean? Well, the architect is going to design, for this example, the space where the kitchen's going to be. And it's going to be a big box. That's all it is on the drawings, because they're not going to be designing the layout or anything. The kitchen designer is going to have its program and requirements of how much space it needs to be. And so that's the very first thing, is they're going to say, I need X amount of square feet, and I need this much ventilation, and I need this much electrical, and I need this much plumbing, and all the stuff that the kitchen designer is going to require in order to make sure that the project, that they can put their design in. And so the two have to coordinate. They have to coordinate. So when the architect is drawing the electrical power systems for the building, they have to have the information from the kitchen designer to put those into the drawings. And so how does that dialogue happen because there's no contract between the architect and the kitchen designer. You know, the architect may have some of its own specialty, you know, like a high voltage lighting design or whatever. And they're under their own contract, so they have their own methodology. But in this instance, you got to have a communication or a connection. And what it says here is that the owner needs to coordinate the services with its own consultant. So the owner comes to its kitchen designer and says, all right, I need you to have these meetings and I need this and this and this. But if something goes wrong, if the information is not properly provided by the kitchen designer to the lead architect, that's the owner's problem, not the architect's problem, because they didn't properly coordinate. Sometimes what you need to do is when you enter into the contract with your kitchen designer, because of this provision, you say, kitchen designer, you need to make sure that you're fully coordinated with the architect, and if you can't or don't do that, you have to give notice to the architect and me, and if you fail to properly coordinate, it's your cost and responsibility. And the reason why is so, let's say we're finally building this, and you only have one contractor building it, and they're building it out, and things don't work. Well, you're going to first look to your main architect and say, did you do it right? And they're going to say, look, it's not my problem. See this provision. And then you're going to need to go back to your kitchen designer and say, did you do it right? Because whatever costs that the contractor is going to charge to fix it, to get it to work right, it's coming out of the owner's pocket. And the owner wants to have a place to get reimbursed for those costs. So the obligation in this contract is it's the owner's fault, so when you're contracting with your kitchen designer, you want to make sure you can pass that responsibility down to them. The last part of this paragraph talks about insurance and otherwise, and that's, you always want to have insurance for the regular architect. If you remember in Article 2, and we briefly went over it because we had already had a whole lecture earlier in the semester on insurance. But since you're requiring your architect to carry insurance, it's only fair that you require your consultant to carry insurance. And the architect wants that as well, because that way, if there's something that goes wrong, and maybe it's even where there's two people that both parties have some fault or some liability, in those instances, it's better if the architect and the consultant have insurance, so there's two deep pockets, the carriers, from which you can get compensation to pay back. Okay. Just checking the chat. All right, so any questions on this coordination and how the owner's responsible for coordination? You guys, that all make sense? Okay. This is something, and coordination, it's often kind of glanced over in construction contracts, and you'll see language. We'll talk about coordination, and the same thing in the owner contractor agreement. But it is very important. Now, what I will say, I don't necessarily modify this often in the owner architect agreement, but there's very similar language in the owner contractor agreement. So let's say for the owner contractor agreement, in addition to bringing in a kitchen designer, you bring in a specialty kitchen contractor. So somebody that specifically builds out these high-end, high-tech kitchens, which is not unusual as well. So in that instance, it says owner shall be responsible for coordinating the services of its subcontractor with the general contractor. For that, just in my own sense, I often change the contract to put the responsibility on the general contractor. And when we get to the 201, I'll talk about that more in detail. So sometimes I'll modify some of these provisions to place the responsibility back on the prime. Here, most of the time, I don't put it on the architect, but I will do it on the contractor. Okay, next. 5.9. Owners shall furnish tests, inspections, and reports required by law. So it talks about mechanical, chemical tests, and so forth. So if there's going to be certain types of materials being put in, or if the soils have certain, let's say there's hazardous materials that are found in the soil, if you do your soil borings and it turns out there's arsenic in it or some other type of chemical, the owner needs to provide that information on the inspections and reports, and if any testing needs to be done. the architect may point out, hey, we got to run a test here, but it's the obligation of the owner to organize that, to pay for it, and to make sure all that information by law comes in. So, and again, you want to think about that. Sometimes there's tests being run on the actual construction of the property and of the project, but most of the time it's going to be done on the land. But for example, I do a lot of work for power companies, and when you're making, you know, when you make electricity, if you're dealing with some of the fossil fuels, if you're burning coal or you're burning gas, you're going to have emissions. And so one of the things that we do, what we build, what are called the back ends, so they're called AQCS or SCRs, they're basically huge construction projects that the end result uses either a mechanical, like either filters or otherwise, or they use a chemical process to remove the particles, in particular in the hazardous materials, the mercury and SO2 and other things that are in the exhaust from burning coal. So you don't, you know, the old smokestacks used to have black smoke coming out. Now when you go by a coal-fired plant, you're going to see this white poofy, and that's mostly just steam because that smoke has been cleaned or scrubbed. So the construction project is to build the scrubber, the equipment that the smoke goes through to ultimately go from black to white fluffy. So in those projects, because it either uses like a mechanical or a chemical process or a combination of both, the contractor is obligated, when it's finished building this scrubber, that the emissions from the smokestacks has to meet certain EPA standards. And you test those at the end of the project. And if they're not meeting the standards, then the contractor's not finished and they have to do whatever tweaking to get the system to run properly. The test for those, to make sure that the contractor's completed, falls under this, 5.9. So even though that's one spot where you're testing the functionality of the building, but it's still up to the owner to perform those tests and to make sure that they're in compliance with the laws. So, 5.10, you got to provide legal and accounting services, no big deal there. 5.11, the owner shall provide prompt written notice to the architect if the owner becomes aware of any fault or defect in the project, including errors, omissions, and inconsistencies in the architect's instruments of service. So this is an important provision. Think about this as, You can't put your head in the sand. This is kind of the no ostrich, no turtle position here, provision here. So the contract's pretty clear. The party that's responsible for designing this project, that has to make sure that it complies with law, that it has to stand up, all the other things that it has to do, the standard of care, all of that is the architects. And the architects can't get out of that. That's their professional obligation. But what happens if the owner, by way of maybe having conversations with the contractor, maybe with its kitchen designer or some other separate consultant, or maybe the owner has their own people that are sophisticated with knowledge, what happens if they see something wrong in either the design or how the architect's performing its services? Well, this provision basically says, if you see something, owner, you need to raise it. You need to provide proper notice if the owner becomes aware of any fault or defect. Now, the becomes aware is important because it's not obligating the owner to seek out fault or defect in the project or the errors in the drawings. It's if they become aware. So the owner does not need to take on the obligations of the architect, does not need to have the professional standard of care. It doesn't need to act like that. That's not a contractual obligation of this provision. But if it becomes aware, somehow, by their own knowledge or other people informing them, that's when the owner has to speak up. So this is important on that sense. Now, the interesting thing about that is, if the owner doesn't speak up, if the owner becomes aware of a fault or defect and doesn't say anything, does that mean the architect is off the hook? Hey, he didn't tell me it was wrong. Well, that doesn't mean the architect is off the hook. The architect always is responsible for designing in accordance with the standard of care, which means following all laws and codes and otherwise. So, if the owner doesn't know and doesn't say anything, it's all the architect's fault. If the owner does say something, well, it's still the architect's fault, but the architect could say, you failed, once you became aware of that, you failed to mitigate your own damages. And as a result, while you're suing me for $1 million, had you told me when you became aware, the fix would have been $200,000. So while I'm responsible for potentially $200,000 in loss, I'm not responsible for $1 million. So the architect never gets off if the owner's silent. But the architect can use this to reduce the amount of exposure that the architect has. Does that make sense? Okay. All right, 5.12. The owner shall include in the architect's communications with the contractor that relate to or affect the architect's services or professional responsibility. The owner shall promptly notify the architect of any substances, of any direct communications between the owner and the contractor otherwise relating to the project. And then communications with the architect's consultant shall be through the architect. So there's three things in here that are kind of important to think about on how the project goes. So as I told you, every 10 years they update the AIA contracts. So this is the 2017s. In the 2007s and before, both the owner-architect agreement and the owner-contractor agreement were written such that the contractor, if it wanted to communicate with the owner about design stuff, needed to talk to the architect. And the owner had it that way because the owner's like, well, so the contractor told me something about it, but I'm not a designer, so I don't know, so it's not my problem, not my fault. And the owner would be like, but you never told me, or the architect would be like, you never told me, I never was part of this, so why is it my fault? But contractually, it was. So in the redrafting of the 2017s, they recognized, hey, owners really like to get more involved in their projects. As the years go by, the owners are more and more involved. The projects are more high dollars, they're more sophisticated, the owners have a bigger stake in it. And so what was happening is they were recognizing that contractor-owner were talking a lot of times without the architect at the table. And so the first two sentences, the first one says, the owner shall include the architect in all communications, meaning you, owner, must make sure that the architect is aware when you're talking with the contractor. And then the second part says you have to notify of the substances of any direct communications. So everybody in the first paragraph, everybody's all in the know. And the second is, if you have that conversation with the contractor, you must make sure that the architect knows exactly what the substance of that communication was. And that then keeps the architect in the loop. So this is good for both the architect and the owner. In one sense, it protects the architect because now the architect, if it's left out, isn't still responsible, because in 2007s, if you were left out but something was important, the architect could still be held. This one takes care of that. It also recognizes that the owner, this is why it's good for the owner, is the owner can now communicate directly to the contractor about some design stuff. As long as the owner loops the architect back in, the project can keep moving forward. The same project that I had this meeting with yesterday, where they had the director's meeting last week about this incentive bonus, the architect had been left out of the loop in some of the communications because the contractor and the owner wanted to move faster, faster, faster. And it was important to bring the architect in, but the owner wanted to still keep moving because the architect itself was moving slowly. So this provision allowed the process to keep moving, the project to continue to stay on schedule, and it was not based on staffing or otherwise. As long as everybody got the communications, it went further. It went fine. The last part of this provision, it talks about communication, and this is kind of more the traditional. Communications with the owner, the architect's consultants shall be through the architect. Meaning, the owner needs to, if you and the contractor are talking about the electrical lighting system, and the owner and the contractor have that without the architect, the owner has the obligation to tell the architect about that. but the owner cannot talk to the electrical engineer. That is one of the architect's consultants. So to get the information to the electrical engineer, the owner needs to only communicate it to the architect. And that's better. Single point responsibility, less chance of who said, he said, she said, and so you can't, you don't want to have that third party with whom nobody has a contract, or at least the owner doesn't have a contract, nor the contractor, having those direct communications. Any questions there? Okay. 513. Before executing your contract for construction, that's the A201 and the whatever the A100 series is, the owner shall coordinate the architect's duties and responsibilities, etc. So what this says, and they provide the architect with a copy of the executed agreement. So what this says is, as I told you, kind of the AIA documents work as a collective suite. And so you may have, so we have what you guys, what we're going through today and last week is the standard, unedited, basic AIA form for the owner-architect agreement. And when we go through the A201, it'll be the standard basic. So the provisions where they overlap or talk about, when we talk about a contractor in here, it's going to be the exact same way in the other document. And when we talk about the architect in the other document, the language is going to be the exact same here. However, if you look at one of my AIA contracts, it will be edited and redlined. There are various provisions that I like to add and subtract depending on who I'm representing. And so when you change the upfront owner-architect agreement, it may impact a similar provision in the owner-contractor agreement. So what 513 says is, okay, I now negotiate this owner-architect agreement, and the architect starts designing, and I put that into on my shelf in my office, and it sits there. And then 6, 8, 10 months later, after the drawings are done, we bring in the contractor, and we negotiate that construction contract. What this says is, before we finalize this construction contract, I have to pull that architect agreement off the shelf, and I have to look at all the provisions that changed from the standard boilerplate language, and if they affect how this contractor thinks the architect is going to work, I have to update it there. So let's go back to my kitchen designer example. If there are edits in the B101, the owner-architect agreement, that recognizes the duties and responsibilities of the kitchen designer different from the way this contract is written, I need to make sure the contractor knows that there's a separate kitchen designer and that's what she's going to be doing on the project. So that's this coordination, this coordinate the two contracts together. And then the second part of this is, and then when you sign this construction contract, you give it to the architect, because the architect later on, if you remember from last week, in Article 3, it talked about the various phases, and the last phase that the architect has is the construction administration phase, and that's when the architect walks around the project site and makes sure that the project is being built in accordance with the drawings and specifications. And in doing so, the architect wants the rules to monopoly between the owner and the contractor. And the only way the architect can get that is to get a copy of that finalized signed agreement between owner and contractor. Again, all this is intuitively very simple, but you want to put it into the provision to the agreement so everybody knows, yes, you're supposed to do this, the owner's supposed to do this part, or the architect's supposed to do that part. Okay? Last one in here that I have highlighted is 5.15. Within 15 days after receipt of a written request from the architect, the owner shall furnish requested information necessary and relevant for the architect to evaluate and give notice or enforce lien rights. Now, we haven't talked about mechanics liens very much yet, but I will we'll have some later lectures on that, but the very simplest to understand what this is saying here in this agreement. A mechanics lien is a right that is created under the law to allow, in construction and property projects only, to allow a third party to assert what's called a lien, place of encumbrance on the title, in order to get paid for its work. Think about it this way. I hire an architect to design my house. The architect hires an electrical engineer. The electrical engineer provides $10,000 worth of services and doesn't get paid. But the services for the electrical engineering in the house is part of the drawings. And so when the house is built, the owner is getting the benefit of those $10,000 worth of services. Well, the electrical engineer can always sue the architect because presumably they have a contract together. But the architect may not want to pay, or maybe says you did it wrong or what have you. And in the meantime, the owner is enjoying the benefits of that electrical engineering services because the house is finished or it's being built and there's going to have this really nice electrical system. And so the lien allows the electrical engineer to place a lien on the property and to sue the owner for its $10,000 worth of services. Same thing happens in the construction side. A subcontractor can sue. Because since there's no contract between the electrical engineer and the owner, they can never bring that lawsuit. But it doesn't seem fair because the owner is enjoying the benefit. Same thing in the construction side. There's no contract between the plumber and the owner. So they can't bring a lawsuit because there's no contractual lawsuit. So they have this lien rights. So what 515 basically says is if the owner, and this goes back to the provision on the screen, if the architect says, I need to know what the information is about liens, whether it's the description of the property or whatever, the owner has to provide that information. And that's to make sure that the architect or its consultants can protect their rights for the services they've done. Okay? All right. Any questions on owner's responsibilities? Good. Cost of the work. So I talked about cost of the work, and if you remember when we were going through Article 3, or maybe no, actually it was even Article 1, we were talking about the initial information, I pulled in a couple of provisions from Article 6 when we were talking about the difference between budget and cost of the work. So we'll go through this hopefully relatively quickly. So definition, cost of work, you've already seen this before, and that was highlighted in blue, is the total cost of the owner to construct all of the projects designed or otherwise specified by the architect and shall include the contractor's general conditions, costs and overheads and profit. So it has nothing to do with paying the architect, it has nothing to do with buying the land, other stuff. It's what it costs to actually build the project. What you're effectively what you're paying the contractor is the cost of the work. Now, the one thing that's a little different in sometimes how the definition looks, because it says, and shall include the contractor's general conditions, cost, overhead, and profit. The way cost of the work is defined in very detail in the owner-contractor agreement will not include overhead and profit, because that's normally a markup, a percentage that they add on top of things. So if it just said cost of the work is the elements designed to build the project, that wouldn't be necessarily everything. That's why they say including the general conditions, overhead, and profit. But just think about it as, for the purposes of this contract, what it costs to build the project. 6.2. The owner's budget, so that's different, for the cost of the work is provided the additional information, we know, and it's adjusted throughout the project as required under 5.2, 6.4, and 6.5. So you have to keep up, and this is kind of repetitive of what's elsewhere, but when we're in this cost of work section, we want to define it. So there's a preliminary estimate of the cost of the work that's provided by the architect, and if that gets increased, then the cost of the work, or your budget has to be increased. So you have to have this give and take back and forth to make sure that the budget and the cost of the work match or stay within the same parameters. The final kind of highlighted portion of this provision says, the architect cannot and does not warrant or represent that bids negotiated will not vary from the budget or the cost of the work or any estimate of the cost of the work prepared or provided by the architect. So what this says, this provision, the last part of this provision, is that I know I'm the architect and under Article 3 at the end of schematic design, design development, construction document phase. At the end of each of those three phases, I need to update my estimate for the cost of the work. And I need to make sure, as if I'm communicating with the owner, But my estimate stays within the owner's budget. And if it goes out of the budget, we have to have a conversation. So that's all in Article 3, and we talked about that last week. What happens, though, is sometimes you blow the estimate. And if that happens, then the owner's like, well, you promised that we'd be able to do this house for $1 million, and the bids are coming back at 1.3. That doesn't mean that the architect has to pay for the additional $300,000 over what was in the preliminary estimate. And that the reason why is because this provision here says the architect cannot and does not warrant or represent that the bids will not vary from the budget. So the architect is doing its best job possible to design in accordance with the budget and provide estimates for the cost of the work. But until it goes out for bid, you just won't know. So let me go back to the project I keep raising today that I had. They had the meeting with the owners, the big the principals last week. So we went out to bid for that project in March and April of 2020, and the architect had made a number of cost estimates. It's a fairly expensive building, just about $200 million. And that was the owner had a very strict budget of where they needed to be, and went out to bid, and the bids came back about, the cheapest bid came back at about 18% over the architect's estimate. As you might imagine, the owner and the management of the owner were a little bit hot, because they're like, we've engaged you for 2 years, we have gone through this over and over, how did you blow it? Well, one of the things that happened is COVID hit. Costs were different. Was that the reason why it was 18% over? Who knows? That was one reason, I think. I think there was other reasons involved. I think the architect maybe was a little bit trying to make sure that they kept the owner happy. Who knows what it is? But with this language here, the architect was able to say, I didn't guarantee you. And that's what's important, because I'm not going to be the one that has to pay for this 18% overrun. Now, how do we fix it? That's coming up in Articles 6.4 and 6.5. But this is the, I won't say it's a complete get-out-of-jail-free card, but it is to say, I, as the architect, am not going to give you any guarantee of the pricing. That's not what I do. I design it, I do everything I can, I do the best I can, as long as it's within the standard of care, then we're okay. When we get to 6.4 and 6.5, I'll explain how we resolved it. So 6.3 kind of talks about what the architect needs to do in preparing that estimate. They have to have contingencies for the design, price escalation, maybe there's things that that the scope is going to change. And so what this is talking about here in 6.3 is when they're preparing the estimate of the cost of the work, the architect should build in some leeway, some fudge factor, to make sure that we're going to not blow the budget. So that's your responsibility. And it's kind of interesting in the sense that you think about that a contractual obligation for you as the architect is to make sure there may be some fluff in the budget when you're doing this estimate. But it's for everybody's benefit. You don't want to over-design and be in the situation we were last spring where the project was 18% over budget. It does include also, if the owner wants detailed cost estimating, they can provide that as an additional service, so they can get paid more. So sometimes architects will actually have a cost estimator on staff, but they're not designers. Their job is specifically to figure out what the costs are. I have a project right now, a very small project. Small is depending on who's paying the bill. But we have a fix of a problem for about $1 million, and the owner thinks that, and the owner and the engineer think that the contractor's pricing is too high. So we're going to bring in a specialized cost estimator to see if we can figure out, is the contractor's pricing at $1 million too high, or is there a better way to get the numbers down? So this provision says if the owner wants to have detailed cost estimating, the architect shall provide such services. They get paid for it, but they have to provide it. Okay, 6.4 and 6.5. And 6.6 is also in how we fixed it. So In 6.4 it says, the bidding negotiation is not commenced within 90 days after the construction documents are submitted. So we go through, we do the design, schematic design, design development, construction documents, and we give them to the owner, and we say, okay, go out to bid. Well, if the owner doesn't go out to bid within 90 days, the architect can come back and adjust the cost of the work budget. And they're going to say, look, my budget was based on when I gave you the drawings. And if you waited 90 days, there's a lot of stuff that could happen that could change and affect the pricing. That was part of the COVID thing that happened with this big project of ours. The architect had been working on this thing for many years, or for a couple of years, and we were supposed to go out to bid right after the first of the year. But there were some changes by the owner, and so we wanted to get all the drawings right, and we wanted everything just right. And it turned out that the drawings didn't go out for bid until April 1st. Well, that was right after COVID. And so the architect, and when we talked about how to fix those, they're like, well, we gave you the stuff in January. We went out in April, and COVID hit, which that's things that affected the construction market. So we can't be held to that budget that we gave you because life has changed. So that was a real-world application of 6.4 of what happens when society, when things that can impact in the market what the pricing are. So, 6.5. If at any time the estimate of the cost of the work exceeds the budget, the architect shall make appropriate recommendations to adjust the project size, quality, or budget for the cost of the work, and the owner shall cooperate. So this says, I got my $1 million housing budget. I told you that. You come back to me, and I told you everything I wanted in the house. You come back to me, and you say, okay, I'm estimating, this is before we even go out to bid, my estimate is it's going to be $1.2 million. So you can either increase your budget, or we can change your design. And then the owner shall cooperate with the architect. Either the owner has to do one of the two. If it won't change its design, it's got to change its budget. If it doesn't want to change its budget, it has to change the design. So these are shall obligations for the, both the architect shall and the owner shall, obligations under 6.5. And that's one of the things that we did when we got this budget, this $200 million facility. It was 18% over budget. There was a big discussion about what needed to happen. So, if the owner's budget, under 6.6, if the owner's budget for the cost of the work at the conclusion of the construction document phase is exceeded by the lowest bona fide bidder negotiation proposal, so that's what happened, the lowest bid that we got on this project was 18% over budget. What happens? The owner shall give written approval of an increase in budget. That wasn't going to happen on our end. They would authorize rebidding or renegotiation of the project. Well, we were at an RFP, so we actually had three or four bids that came in. All of them were over, and so we weren't at the point of rebidding yet, and that was a discussion that had to do. Terminate in accordance with Section 9.5. Well, we didn't want to terminate the architect. We liked the architect. We've been with them for 2 years. And then the last one was, is to revise the project program scope or quality. And that's what we ended up doing. We went back and we said, we can't afford this price for this project. What can we do? And there was multiple structures in the project. So we had to take one structure that was a four-story structure, and we had to reduce it to two. There were other elements about the design that were, we had to take some of the more aesthetic, artistic elements of it, because it was a production facility, and eliminate those. So we had to change the program in order to make sure that we remained within the budget. So that was based on this, because it says the owner shall. We had one of these five, the others implement mutually accepted alternatives. We had one of these five obligations or alternatives to choose, and we chose sub four. Revise the program scope or quality is required to reduce the cost of the work. So that's what we did on the owner's side. Now, as you remember, we had this provision where the architect says, I can't guarantee the pricing. And now we got the owner that says, okay, we got to change the design. But boy, it seems kind of unfair that if the if the architect just blew the bid, yeah, there was COVID and everything else, but 18%, well, that was pretty hard. But the architect kind of really blew it. So why should the architect get off? Because if we're going to be doing revising the program, they're going to have to issue new drawings. So yes, we opted to do section sub 4, 6.6.4, to revise the program. But the only party that could revise the program is the architect. So how do we make sure that it's fair? Well, that's what 6.6.7 says. If the owner chooses to proceed under 6.6.4, which is what we did here, revise the program, scope, or quality, without additional compensation, the architect without additional compensation shall modify the construction documents as necessary to comply with the owner's budget. So what this says is, we have a $200 million budget. You knew it. You always told us we were under budget. In fact, they said we were actually about 10% under budget, which was kind of ironic that we came in and we were 18% over. And so we opted to revise our scope. And as a result, the architect here had to redo the designs for free. So all the hours that they went ahead and spent on fixing the scope to match the budget, because the bids were too high, the architect did not get paid for them. And that's based on 6.7. That's important. I think it's fair, if you think about it, if the owner has said all along, here's my budget, and the architect has all along said you're within budget, and then it comes in that you've blown the budget, and the owner has to then revise what the project is going to be like. It's only fair that under 6.7, the architect does it for free. Now, as a tip for you guys, often the architect will put in a percentage here. They're not going to say if it's a dollar over the budget. They're going to say if it's within 10%. And that's what we actually had. We had a number of 10% on this. We negotiated that if the bids came in within 10% of the budget, the architect and the owner needed to redesign, the architect would pay for it. If it was over 10%, the architect had to do it for free. But we were at 18%. There was never really a question. So we made them design for free. They pushed back. They tried to use the COVID argument. They tried to do some other stuff. But at the end of the day, they ended up doing the work because contractually they were obligated to do it. All right, that's it for cost of work. Any questions there? Okay. Article 7. This is real important too, copyrights and license. Just as a side, because I was telling you guys last week, so there's going to be some questions where it won't say for those two articles we just went through, 5 and 6, it's not going to be like, which of the following four choices are the owner's obligations under the contract? It won't be listed like that. There'll be a paragraph that'll talk about the owner does this and that. The owner is on the project communicating and does this and that. And then the question will be to the effect of, was this the proper course of action? In that, you have to read the text to see, was the owner acting in accordance with its obligations? And then you would go back and say, well, here's the duties that the owner had under Article 5. And when you're reading the paragraph, you say, okay, yes, did the owner properly inform the architect of the communications with the contractor? It won't say, that won't be the question, but there'll be a fact scenario where maybe the owner has not communicated. And then you can make your answer on that. Same thing with cost of the work. There's going to be questions where the term cost of the work is used. And so your familiarity with Article 6 will help you understand how that will be applied in the question. So there will be two or three questions on the exam for sure on this section, this article called Instruments of Service. It's called Copyrights and License, but it talks about the Instruments of Service. So I've said this a few times in the semester. Obviously, the services you provide is how you make your money. You know, you're going to design services, you consult, all this other stuff. But you want to make sure that this is one of your most important rights that you have. Even though the owner's hiring you, even though it's the owner's idea, they want to have this type of, you know, they want this toy factory or your million-dollar house or whatever it is, it's still your intellectual property. It's your creative right, your creative license, your creativity that makes these drawings and specifications. And so, you have the copyright. Under the law, you have the copyright. You own that in the drawings. They call it the instruments of service. There's a definition coming up here, because it's a defined term. The I and the S are capitalized. Include this whole laundry list of stuff, so you don't have to repeat it to everyone else. But what this is, this, so we're going to talk about the value of your rights and what's in them, and then how does the owner, if you have the copyright, how does the owner get the ability to use your drawings? Because technically, if you drew a building under the Architecture Works Copyright Act of 1990, and someone built that building from your drawings, that construction of that building technically is an infringement of the copyright. Because it's a copy. It's a copy of your drawing. Your drawing becomes a three-dimensional and becomes that building. That's an infringement. Because somebody has made something and made money off of you from your drawings. So how does then construction happen if you own the copyright and every time somebody builds a building, they're infringing it? Well, it talks about here in 7.1. They're going to transmit, the transmitting party to copyright owner is the copyright owner of such information and or has permission from the copyright owner to transmit such information. So this right away says, we recognize that the instruments of service, your drawings and specifications, you, the architect, are the owner. And when the owner is giving that, they're transmitting that to the contractor. They have the permission from the architect to give those drawings for the contractor to use. So that's what 7.1 says. 7.2, the architect and the architect consultant shall be deemed authors and owners of their respective instruments of services. So, the electrical engineer is the author and the owner of its electrical drawings. Even though it's rolled into the architectural whole set, there's going to be your architecturals, your mechanicals, your electricals, your structurals. All those drawings will be in the full set of drawings that are provided to the contractor to build it. But each consultant that prepared the electrical, the mechanical, and the structural, they own their respective instruments of service. They're the copyright owners. 7.3. Upon the execution of this agreement, so once you sign this agreement, which actually is before any drawings are created normally, the architect grants to the owner, I give to you, owner, a non-exclusive license. I'm giving you a license to use my instruments of service. But it's narrow, solely and exclusively for the purpose of constructing, using, maintaining, alterating, and adding to the project. So you can use it to build the project, you can use it to do additions to the project, you can do maintenance, but that's it. You can't use these drawings to build that million-dollar house twice. You can use it for this project and this project only. You can't have, you know, sometimes you'll have a project where the developer's going to put up a series of high-rises, but they're all going to be the same. In fact, when I used to live in the city, there was an apartment high-rise right behind me, and it was a huge lot. And the initial plan was for the owner to develop three towers, and they developed the first one and only the first one. Well, if he wanted to do the second tower, and it was supposed to be literally a mere cookie cutter of the first tower, if the developer wanted to do the second tower, they did not have a copyright license. They didn't have a license for that second tower. They would have gone back to the architect and say, I want to do the second tower. Will you grant me a license for that? And there would be negotiations and price and a whole bunch of other stuff. So that's what this first portion says. And then the second of it says, the license granted in this section permits the owner to authorize the contractor, subs, etc., as well as the owner's consultants, so that kitchen designer and separate contractors, to reproduce these instruments of service. So you can make copies, guys. It's even though it would be copyright infringement, I'm giving you the authorization of this license to make copies of extra sets of drawings and specifications solely and exclusively for the performance of services or construction of the project. Again, it has to be tied to the specific project. Last part of this provision that's important. The architect rightfully terminates this agreement for causes provided 9.4, and that's just basically I don't get paid or the owner's in breach. If I, the architect, terminate, I fire you, owner, this license goes away. And so that's one thing where I think I told you guys the story of where I represented the lighting designer. They got fired. They weren't getting paid. The owner brought in a new lighting designer to build the project, to finish out the drawings, and the project was currently underway. They were owed about $450,000, and I went to federal court because copyright law is federal law, and I went under an injunction under Article 7.3, and I said, we haven't been paid, we terminated our agreement, the license has expired, they are infringing our copyright, and we were able to get the project, get my client paid relatively quickly because this is pretty cut and dry. So that's the use of this provision. It's a very powerful provision. It's very protective of you as the architect, and it should be because it's your work product and your it's how you guys make money. Any questions on 7.3? Okay. After this section, we're going to take a quick break. 7.4, in the event the owners are using instruments and services without retaining the author of the instruments and services, so they build that second tower, and I don't hire the first architect, but I have the drawings. The owner releases the architect and the architect's consultants from all claims and causes of actions arising from such uses. Even if, and here's the interesting thing, let's say that a portion of the drawings were incorrect. They weren't a code. The first building gets built, and maybe the contractor catches it and fixes it. Whatever happens, it's not a problem. They build the second building, and the owner doesn't go to the first architect and builds the second tower. And this defect still exists in the drawings. And it's constructed, and the defect causes an injury, causes some error, where the wall falls down. Because the owner didn't hire the architect, the architect that drew them, for this phase two, there's an argument that can be made that even though the architect did not comply with the standard of care, even though there's an error by the architect, because of this provision, because the architect, the first architect was not hired, the owner has released that architect from any claims. So the cost and the damages relating to the wall falling down, even though it's the architect's fault, the owner cannot sue the architect for it based on this provision. Because they didn't hire him. And the reason why is you're like, well, wait a minute. The architect's still screwed up. I thought you said earlier, like, just because the owner doesn't say something, the architect's still liable because the architect ultimately screwed up. The architect's response to that is, under this one, is, okay, yeah, we built the first phase. The error is in that one. Nobody caught it. Maybe the contractor caught it. I don't know, but nothing has come from it, so you don't have a loss yet. But I may have discovered that in phase two. I may have seen it. It may have come up if you had me on site. But you didn't. So you never gave me an opportunity to fix my mistake for phase two. And since you didn't give me the opportunity, I can't be held liable for not performing in accordance with the standard of care for phase two because I was never involved. And our contract's for phase one only. You can't create some contract with me for phase two when we don't have anything. So you can't sue me for that. So that's what this is here. And in fact, it goes further. That's the second half of this provision. But the owner agrees to indemnify and hold harmless the architect and consultants relating to any of these claims that might come up. So what does that mean? Well, let's say the wall falls down in the building of phase two, and it falls on the tenant that lives in that apartment. And the tenant is badly injured. The tenant sues the owner and finds out that the architect, well, they didn't work on phase two, finds out who the architect is that designed it. Well, this provision says the owner releases from claims, but the tenant doesn't have a contract with anybody. So under tort law, as you remember, the tenant could sue the architect because the architect screwed up. Tenant's like, you designed it. You weren't performing the standard of care. I got injured because of your screw-up architect. I can sue you. And it's right. They can. But what this second half of this provision says is that the owner needs to indemnify and hold harmless the architect. What that means is the owner needs to step in, and if there's a claim against the architect, the owner has to pay for the architect's damages. So it goes to a jury, and the jury says, okay, it's $1 million loss, and they apportion the fault, and they say, $200,000 is the owner's fault, and $800,000 is the architect's fault because they designed it and the wall fell down on what they designed. Because of this provision of indemnifying and hold harmless, the owner has to pay the full $1 million. The architect doesn't have to pay anything because the owner didn't bring in the architect. And the owner couldn't let the architect protect itself against third parties, and so the owner has to indemnify the architect for these third-party claims. Make sense? Okay. Let's see any more slides we have in this one. Last slide, and then we'll take a break. Except for the license granted under this Article 7, no other license shall be deemed granted or implied. So you can't have, if I design for you the building that's part of the project, I give you the license for that. If I'm doing something else for you, I don't give you a license for something else. Or I'm not giving you a license for phase two. I'm not giving you a license to take some of my drawings and repeat it not on a phase two but elsewhere. It's narrow. It's specific for this project, what it says and what it's used for. I can't give these drawings to a friend of mine. I can't give these drawings to some other company. If I leave the company I'm with and go somewhere else, I can't give them to those. The project, I can only give them to the contractors and the subcontractors and my third party, you know, my kitchen designer. And I only have a license for that. That's it. And if I do any of those, if I do go to phase two, if I take the drawings for myself, if I give them to somebody besides the contractor and the subcontractors, this says here, any unauthorized use, so all those are unauthorized, shall be at my own risk. So these last, this provision, 7.3 and 7.4, are truly the get-out-of-jail-free cards for the architect. Hey, I'm going to design it for you. You got to pay me for it. But if you don't pay me, license terminates. Or, if you're using it for another project, I have no responsibility. You have to handle that yourself. So, very powerful provisions, Article 7. You own the copyright, you own the control, licenses are limited, and if the owner deviates from those, owner buyer beware. It's owner's risk, not the architect's. So this is one of the best provisions for you guys in this agreement with respect to when there's a deviation from the project and what's going on. Okay, so we're starting Article 8 now. Claims and disputes. Let's take it's 10:20. Let's take a 10-minute break and meet back here at 10:30. Okay, great. Okay, let's fire back up again. Now we're going to talk about claims and disputes. So one of the things that obviously happens on every construction project is there's going to be claims that are made. I've never had a construction project where there wasn't claims. And claims don't necessarily mean a bad thing. It just means that, the drawings weren't sufficient or there wasn't enough information. That doesn't mean that there was an error necessarily, but there's a claim by the contractor that says I should get paid more money. Or sometimes it's a claim by the owner that the contractor screwed up. Or it's a claim that there's an architect that they did something wrong. So in every contract, you want to make sure, whether it's owner-contractor, owner-architect, or even just in a general contract you have between the parties, you need to have some type of rules, the monopoly rules, to figure out what happens when there's a dispute. How do you solve those disputes, through the claims and disputes? So that's what Article 8 talks about. 8.11, the owner and the architect shall commence all claims and causes of actions, whether in contract, tort, or otherwise, within the period specified in the applicable law, but in any case not more than 10 years after the date of substantial completion of the work. So this is a time frame in which you have to bring that. We talked about statute of limitations in our second or third lecture that said you have so many years in Illinois, it's if you knew or should have known within 4 years to bring a claim, and that's the period where it says the period specified by applicable law. But in any case, not more than 10 years after substantial completion. Now, if you remember in Illinois, it's that 4 years, but there's the 10-year discovery period, so that's called the statute of repose. So it could go up to 14 years. So this provision would limit it to 10. So if you're in Illinois, turn this off. If you're in Illinois, this would limit it to the 10 years, even though the statute says 14. So I, when I'm an owner, when I represent an owner, I strike this 10-year provision, and I just say within the period specified by applicable law, and I strike the 10-year provision after that. But generally, it's saying the top of the longest you can wait is 10 years. So that's what that says. It creates a contractual statute of limitations. 812. To the extent that damages are covered by property insurance, owner architect waive rights against each other and against contractors, etc., etc. So as long as, except for that they may have proceeds of the insurance. So what this says is, if there is property insurance and there's a property loss, and we can recover under that, then we're going to try to get the proceeds from that insurance that's set forth. And so that's just an insurance one. You don't have to worry about that for the exam, but there are provisions that talk about how insurance is going to be used on these projects. 813. This is something that's in almost every construction contract, whether it's design professional agreement or construction with the owner contractor. Architect and owner waive consequential damages for claims, disputes, or other matters in question arising out of or relating to this agreement. So consequential damage is something that is not directly related to the project. So I have this very instance in a construction claim right now. I have a client that opened a hotel. The hotel was up and running, and then there was some damage to a bar area. The pressurized system for the beer and the other alcohol, it exploded. And as a result, they had to shut down the bar, they had to rebuild part of the bar, they had to rebuild some of the floor, and they had to shut down a portion of the hotel restaurant that was making money for them. So the cost to fix the pressurized system, that's directly related to the work in the project. The cost of fixing the floor, the cost of fixing the damaged bar, those were all costs directly related to the project. The consequential damages as a result of that is the lost revenue for the business, so business interruption. And so the waiver here says is the owner can't sue if in this case it was against the contractor, but it's the same concept. If the reason why the pressurized system blew up was because of the design error, the owner could sue the architect for the cost to fix the physical stuff that was damaged, but could not sue the owner for the lost profits, the lost revenue that they made because they had to close the restaurant, because that's a consequential damage. The reason why you do this in construction projects is because there are so many potential areas of where there could be lost revenue or lost things that it could be a new, it could just be massive. So it has become an industry practice that there should be a mutual waiver, mutual owner and architect both waive, consequential damages. The same thing could be as, so let's say the owner fails to pay the architect timely. So how does it work the other way? So the owner fails to pay the architect timely, so the architect slows down the process, and the project gets slowed down. And the architect thought that they were going to be done with the design process by December 31st, and they had an architect, one of the guys in the team, one of the architects, she was going to go and work on a new project. The owner slow drags it, and the project gets extended out because of the owner's fault into January and February. Well, the architect can't take the lead architect off the project because she's part of the design team. And as a result, the architect loses a really nice commission that she was going to work on. This architect, she was going to work on this other project starting January 1st. And so as a result, the firm loses the commission. Well, clearly the owner breached the contract by slow paying, and clearly it's the owner's fault that the work went out into January and February for the first project. So the architect can all the costs that they incur to do additional work and everything else, the architect can sue the owner for those additional costs. But they can't sue for the consequences of losing the other project. Let's say that they lost, you know, a million dollar commission from the other project they weren't able to put the architect on, so she couldn't be there. This waiver of consequential damages says the architect can't sue the owner for those consequences. So, mutual is important, and waiver, and then it's, again, you're going to see this in the owner-contractor agreement as well. That makes sense? Okay. Mediation. So, I think we talked about this as far as different ways that you can have dispute resolution. And so what the AIA contract has done with the in the architectural world, or the construction world, the construction industry, is construction litigation, where you actually go to court, can be very complex, very expensive, because there's so many drawings and so many documents. You know, you got invoices, you got drawings, you got change orders, you got RFIs. The amount of paperwork in construction projects are massive. And so as a result, if you had to only litigate, if you could only go to court the way to solve disputes, it would just be way too cost prohibitive for everyone. So the first phase in virtually all construction contracts is mediation. And if you remember, mediation is a non-binding resolution between the two parties, so they have this neutral that sits between the two parties and helps them solve, on a business level, the dispute and the cost. And so what it requires here under the AIA contracts is the first step you must do is you must mediate. All claims related to this shall be part of the mediation. And so there's timing and deadlines that are applicable, and if there's liens or otherwise, but that's the first phase, is mediation. And it says, they shall endeavor to resolve claims and disputes and other matters between mediation. And then, if they can't do this, the mediation shall proceed in advance of binding dispute resolution, which could be either arbitration or litigation. So we have a step process. First step is mediation. Second step, if they can't solve it, this says the second step would be some binding resolution, and it could be litigation or arbitration. So how do you know? Which are we doing first? What are we doing after, if the mediation doesn't work? Well, 8.2.4 says, if the parties do not resolve the dispute through mediation, then they shall go to binding dispute as one of the following. And you have to, when you fill out this contract, you have to check the box. It's either arbitration, litigation, or others. Sometimes they have things called MEDARB or ARB-MED. There's these specialty type of special masters, or otherwise. Traditionally, it's going to be arbitration or litigation. For my preference, when I represent, whether it's an owner or a contractor or an architect, my preference is to do mediation then litigation. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the, and I think I've mentioned it before, some of the problems with arbitration. I don't think it used to be, it was a more cost-efficient method and kept you out of the courts and kept you out of the papers. I don't think it's as, the benefits are as great as they used to be. I think maybe arbitration is as bogged down as litigation is. And you can't have, there's no right of appeal. So I almost always, when I fill out my contracts in construction, the mediation's mandatory, is I click on litigation. Now, there may be times when you represent an owner where they are, they don't want their information to be in a court of law. So private owners, they want to have arbitration, they want arbitration instead of mediation. Or, they may be an area in jurisdiction where they think arbitration will be more beneficial to them. Maybe the public sentiment against them seeing their name in the paper in litigation is not to their favor. So there are some circumstances where I communicate with my client and talk about them that we will go arbitration, but most of the time I'm going to go mediation followed by litigation. So if you go to the arbitration, there's a process under 8.3. They go arbitration, it's going to be in accordance with the rules from the American Arbitration Association, and they have specific rules of how the arbitration proceeds. You can change this. There are other arbitration organizations out there, so you can modify the contract, but the American Arbitration Association is the most predominant, certainly in the construction industry, so everybody kind of knows what these rules are. So this is normally a really kind of a non-factor. Almost everybody, if they're going to go arbitration, will proceed with this as written. You have to file a demand. It talks about when that is. A demand is kind of like a complaint where you lay out what all the problems are in the project and who is responsible for what. And it can't be later than the statute of limitations. So even though arbitration is not in the courts, what this provision 8.3.1.1 says is we still have to follow the rules of the courts with respect to timing of the lawsuit, the statute of limitations. 8.3.2, the agreement to arbitrate shall be specifically enforceable in any court of law. So what this says is you go, you mediate, you can't solve it, you have a $1 million dispute, and you go to arbitration. And arbitration is kind of like a trial, but it's not a judge and jury. It's a panel of one or three individuals that most likely will have a specialty knowledge in the industry. They'll either be a contractor or an architect or a construction lawyer or something like that. And you're going to put on your evidence. And at the end of the arbitration hearings, they're going to come up with a verdict. They're going to have a ruling. So they're going to say, okay, you were suing for $1 million. I found mostly your case I agreed with. I'm going to award you $800,000. Well, how do you collect on that? Well, the arbiters don't have the force of being able to send a sheriff or to garnish somebody's wages or whatever. So what 8.3.2 says is basically you can enforce the arbitration judgment, that $800,000 award, in court. So you get the award, you go to court, if you don't get paid right away, you get the award, then you go to court and you file a claim in court that says, I have an arbitration award for $800,000, and then the court just simply enforces it. They don't hear any merits, they don't hear any testimony, they look at the arbitration award, it says party A is awarded $800,000, and they enter a judgment. And then that judgment can be given to the sheriff, and the sheriff can go out and do what they need to do if the other side isn't paying to get those funds for you. So, and then 8.3.3 says the arbitration shall be final. Any questions so far on mediation arbitration? 8.3.4 talks about consolidation and joinder. So what this basically means is you can consolidate arbitrations together. So I have this project where the wall falls down and someone's injured and I myself am injured for the cost to fix the wall and potentially having to pay the injured party. I bring an arbitration demand against the architect because I have it my B-101 contract. But the contractor may have screwed up too. So I bring an arbitration demand against the contractor. Well, that's a separate proceeding because it's a separate contract. It's not the same one as this one. So what this provision says, 8.3.4.1, means that either party here, the architect or the owner, can consolidate and bring everybody together as long as they have common facts and questions and similar procedures and rules. So if I'm using AIA contracts, everybody's going to be under the American Arbitration Association rules. It's going to be the same project, so the same set of facts. And so it would make sense that to bring everybody to the same party. So it's going to be the owner, architect, and contractor all in one arbitration as opposed to being separate. I have a case right now. It's about a $7 million claim. And there was no consolidation provision in the agreement. It's an old AIA agreement. And this provision does not exist. And so I had to bring two different arbitration demands, and I have requested from the contractor and the architect, would they agree to consolidate? Now, we are still in the mediation process, so we have not gotten to the arbitration process, but we'll eventually probably get there. The contractor has agreed to consolidate. The architect has not. I didn't negotiate the agreement, so this provision that should be there is gone. Whoever struck it shouldn't have it stricken. So now I'm potentially faced with a fact where my client may have to arbitrate the same case twice and potentially have different outcomes. In one case, the arbiters for the architect may say, maybe the architect screwed up, but they're only worth 20% of the screw-up, the other 80 is the contractor. And in the construction arbitration, those panel members, because it's separate, may say, well, the contractor was only responsible for 40% and 60% the architect. Now I have two inconsistent decisions because I don't have a joinder clause. So it's important, especially in construction, to keep everybody together. So this is important just procedurally, so everybody's at the dance at the same time. 8.3.4.2, either party's sole discretion may include joinder persons or equities substantially involved in common question of law or fact. So it doesn't necessarily, so if you look at 8.3.4.1, these are, if the arbitration permits and they substantially questions and civil procedure rules, this one's a little bit that they can bring somebody in on the common questions of law and facts, but not all of those, provided that the party sought to be joined consents in writing. So this is the provision. I don't have the automatic consolidation. I have this provision. And so what I'm saying to the architect now, who's kind of being a holdout, is I'm saying, guys, they have similar common questions of law and fact. I'm asking to join the parties. Will you consent in writing? Contractor has consented in writing. The architect hasn't. I think ultimately the architect will, but at the same time, I have to get it through this provision. So, just as a procedural matter, this is important. Any questions on arbitration and mediation? Okay. Article 9, termination or suspension. So, if something goes wrong in a contract, you may end up terminating. Now, termination, I will say this to you guys, as I say to every single client I've ever had, termination is the nuclear option. Because termination, in any contract you have, it could be very expensive. But in construction, it is always prohibitively more expensive. If you have to terminate your architect before the project's over, you may or may not get the license to use those drawings. And we'll talk about how these provisions allow for that, depending on the circumstances. If you can't use those drawings, you have to pay the architect to start over, the new architect. And that's going to be expensive. And especially if you're under construction, well, then you don't even have the license to use those drawings to complete the construction. You have to use new drawings. So you're going to have a new cost there. And if you terminate a contractor, well, they have this host of knowledge. You have to go out and get a new contractor. You have to get new subcontractors, all those other things. So you really never want to be in a situation for termination. You want to do everything under construction and all possible options to avoid termination. But it happens. Because it happens, you have to have language in the provision. So, 8.9.1. How can the architect terminate? Well, the first one's pretty simple. If the owner fails to make payments to the architect in accordance with its agreement, it's substantial non-performance and the architect can terminate. That's easy. 10 days, or you give 7 days written notice, you can either suspend, and then you give 7 days written notice, and you can terminate. You don't pay me, I'm not going to work for you, I'm terminating the contract. Now, with suspension, you can resume the services. Let's say it's just suspension, and the architect decides to come back. This last part of this provision is important. It says, before resuming services, the architect shall be paid all sums due. So if the owner hasn't paid, it's not just, oh, I promise I'll pay you, and then the architect starts working. One, you have to be caught up to date. And then any expenses incurred in the interruption and resumption of the services. So if you're off for like a month, and you had to adjust your architects working on the project, and then they had to get back up to speed, and there's costs for that that weren't in the original contract, if the owner has failed to pay, and it's the owner's fault, the owner has to pay both the catch-up money and additional costs for the architect to get up to speed. Also, the schedule, the architect and when it has to deliver things have to be adjusted. So if we're down for a month, everything gets pushed out a month. So, well, again, intuitive and makes sense, you want to put it in writing to make sure in the contract that that's the process when you bring everybody back up to speed. 9.2. If the owner suspends the project, so this is a situation where the owner says, okay, let's just halt for a while, I need to make sure that my funds are in the right place, or whatever the reason is for suspension, maybe there's a problem with the city, or I'm not getting the proper zoning permits, maybe I want to have an extended bid period, so we're going to not go out to bid right now, whatever it is, the architect needs to be compensated before it's suspended, so architect's still designing, and they stop at August 1st, and they don't resume back till October 1st. Everything the architect did through August 1st, they have to be paid for. So because of the owner suspension. And then when they start back up in October, if there was any cost the architect incurred in the shutdown, the interim, the owner has to pay those fees. And again, the schedule needs to be adjusted. If the owner suspends the project for more than 90 days under 9.3, the architect can terminate the agreement in 7 days written notice. So 9.1, if you recall from on the screen, fails to make payment, you can terminate. So 9.1 is a payment one. 9.2 and 9.3 are suspensions. So we're just stopping the project for a little while. And 9.3 goes so far as this: if the project is suspended for 90 days, the architects can terminate. They can say, I'm done. Now, I, as a matter of course, when I represent an owner, I strike 9.3. What I say to the architect is, if I'm shut down for 90 days because I can't get financing or this or that, I understand you should get paid for your downtime, but the cost to me if you terminate, let's say we're 6 months into an 8-month design process, and then I have to shut down for 90 days, and you terminate, well, the license goes away, I have to start from scratch, that's just so prohibitive against me, I can't let you terminate just because I had to suspend because I had to go get financing. What I will let you do is suspend yourself, and then when you start back up, I'll pay you for your additional costs. So that's what I do as an owner. But 9.3 doesn't have that. 9.3 says 90 days, the architect can walk away and get paid for everything they've done to date. Now, why would the architect do that? Well, because they have a project. They have a commission, and if the guys are going to come back, well, maybe they see 90 days is going to turn into 180 days, and they don't want to be stuck with it. Or maybe they have that new great project coming down the line, and they need to put their senior architect, she needs to work on the next project. So sometimes they may want to terminate because financially it's a better business for the architect. But most of the time, the parties are going to sit down and talk and try to work it out, not terminate, because as I said in the beginning, terminate's the worst thing for any project. Any questions so far? Okay. Where's my mouse? 9.4. Either party here can terminate the agreement upon not less than 7 days written notice should the other party fail to substantially perform in accordance with the terms of this agreement through no fault of the party initiating termination. That's basically saying if one party has a major breach of the agreement, and it could be payment, but we already know payments 1 and 9.1, either party can terminate. Well, how do you determine if there's a major breach? Well, if you remember, Article 3 details all the obligations that the contract or the architect is supposed to perform under the agreement. And Article 5 details all the obligations of the owner. So if the owner fails to live up to its obligations under Article 5, for example, refuses or fails to ever get a survey to the architect so the architect can properly design, if the architect fails to meet the deadline dates to complete the design development, you know, they're not meeting schedule, either one of those could be argued to be a substantial breach of the agreement and allows either party to trigger a termination under 9.4. Now, as I said, under 9.3, I strike 9.3. I don't want the architect to terminate it except for a non-payment. And on this, I also strike 9.4 because I want to make sure that the owner, and I add in 9.4, revised termination for cause, that basically says the owner can terminate in not less than 7 days if the architect fails to substantially perform. Because once again, I'm paying the money as the owner, but the architect can get compensated for suspension. There's other things that can protect the architect, but the owner could be in much significantly greater financial duress if you give the architect the ability to terminate other than non-payment. But that's my revision when I represent an owner. When I represent an architect, I leave this as is. 9.5, the owner may terminate the agreement upon not less than 7 days. What's this year? Sorry. I had a weird bubble that came up. 7 days written notice for the owner's convenience and without cause. So this is, and this is important. Again, you don't ever want to terminate, but what 9.5 says is, if I'm in a situation where the marriage, the relationship between owner and architect is not working out right, but it may not be so great as that the architect has breached. Are they hitting their dates? Sometimes they hit their scheduled dates, sometimes they don't. Are their budgets, are their estimates of the cost of the work right? They're close, but they're not 100%, but they're just problems. Is the design what I wanted? No, they're not really relating to me. But if none of them, if none of the actions of the architect result in a substantially failure to perform, which is required in 9.4, how do I get out of this bad marriage? I'm stuck with an architect that's doing bad work, that we can't hit dates, but we can, or we're not sure. And I just have this bad feeling, and I'm spending millions of dollars on architectural fees, and I'm going to spend tens of millions of dollars on my building. How do I get out? Well, 9.5 says you can terminate for convenience. You don't have to have the cause. You don't have to have the substantial failure under 9.4. You can just under 9.5 say, I'm terminating you for convenience. And I think that's important that the owner always has that, because it's the owner's money, it's the owner's project, and the owner, while they don't want to terminate for convenience, sometimes has to get out of the bad marriage. And so that's the situation you kind of have to take a look at. Any questions on that? 9.6 just talks about how you're going to get paid for reimbursable expenses, so once the termination happens, everything else. 9.7. Termination expenses, so this is a defined term, are in addition to the compensation for the architect's services. So you do work through August 1st, and there's a termination where the architect should get paid for its work through August 1st. But there may be other costs to terminate, whether they had someone on the project site and they had to pull them out or whatever else. So there's different termination expenses. And so we have to define that. So it's attributable to the termination for which the architect is not otherwise compensated, plus, and here's the big one, if you're an architect, plus an amount for the architect's anticipated profit on the value the service is not performed. This is huge if you're an architect. So if I'm you guys, if you're negotiating this, you want to try to keep this in the contract. It's often stricken, and we don't have a big argument, this last part of this provision, the plus the amount. But if you keep it in, it's great. The reason why is, so let's say that you're working on a project and it's going to be ultimately $1 million fee for you. And on that $1 million, your calculations that you were going to make about a 15% profit. So you're charging them hourly for your architects, workers, and everything else. And you have to pay your lights and your bills and all the other stuff to keep the office running. And we'll have that in the lecture after the break. But you still are, when you're going to get $1 million, you're anticipating that profit on that is $150,000. So you start working, you start moving through, and two-thirds of the way through the project, the owner terminates you for convenience. They're like, all right, well, that sucks. I really like this project, but I'm not going to be working on it. But we can't get into litigation because they terminate for convenience. It doesn't matter whether they did something wrong or not. They're allowed to just walk away. This provision says, well, I've already been paid two-thirds of my $1 million, so of my profit, the 15%, I've already probably earned 10% of that. So I've earned $100,000 of that million is my profit. And even though you've terminated me, I still would have made $50,000 more in profit. You need to pay me my work through August 1st plus that $50,000, even though I'm doing nothing else for the rest of the project. I'm not going to bill you for anything else. I've billed you for $660,000 worth of work. You need to pay me $710,000 because I had $50,000 of profit that I was going to lose since you terminated me. Now, the architect's reason for that is because, look, I had it staffed. I had these people that are going to be working on this through the end of the year. You terminated me in September. There was still time left to finish out. Now I have to, people that were going to be busy, that were going to be making me money, now I got to go out and find other projects for them. I can't promise that they're going to be working on somebody until January. Maybe I actually have a project lined up and I've promised my next client they're not going to start till January, so they have to sit idle. So I'm losing money on my people performing services, and I'm losing profit. So you promised me a project that I would be able to do the whole project through the end of the year. You terminated me early. You pay me for the work I've done, plus lost profits. That's what this is. Now, as I said, most of the time you're going to see this stricken, but in this instance, if you're the architect, do everything you can to keep it in, to get that extra profit. Okay. Any questions on fee? Termination. Okay. Moving on. Article 10. Miscellaneous. So this is just kind of a catch-all. We're just going to zip through these. So, if you have a dispute, you want to go under the Federal Arbitration Act. So now we have kind of another set of rules. We have the arbitration rules under the AAA, but you need to use the Act, which has some other elements of it. Terms of the agreement in this contract are the same as the A201. As I said, I've talked about a couple times, the suite of documents, if it's a capitalized term here, it's the same term there. They all have the same meaning, so everybody's on the same page. Architect and owner bind themselves, their agents, and otherwise to the agreement, meaning we're all, if I'm speaking as on behalf of the owner, I'm an agent. So this is this agency stuff we talked about a couple weeks ago, and now it's actually in the contract. And then neither owner can nor architect can assign this agreement without written consent of the other. So the owner, the architect, let's say the architect is going to be absorbed by another company. Well, can they assign that to the new company? Well, you have to have a written agreement from the owner. Or the owner decides that they aren't going to build the project anymore, but they found somebody else that's going to build phase two or whatever it is. The owner can't assign this agreement. It's between the two parties. Now, if you have written consent, it's fine. But you can't do it without the written consent. Certificates here I wouldn't worry about. 10.5. Nothing in this agreement shall create a contractual relationship or cause of action in favor of a third party against either owner or contractor. Owner or architect. Meaning contractor can't sue the architect because the contractor has an agreement with the owner. Electrical engineer for the architect can't sue the owner because the electrical engineer has an agreement with the architect. This is basic contract law, but as I said, sometimes you want to put it in. So nothing, even though we talk about consultants and we talk about contractors and we talk about a bunch of third parties in the agreement, just because we talk about them, this provision says it doesn't mean that there's any cause of action between those third parties and the principal parties of this contract, the owner and the architect. 10.6, architects shall have no responsibility for the discovery, presence, handling, removal, or exposure of persons to hazardous materials or toxic substances. So this is saying, look, you're responsible for the property, the contractor's responsible for its work. If there's toxic waste on that land, remember, you did the geotech, not me. And if there's toxic, if the soils are toxic, or they have, like I said, you know, arsenic is an example, I use that because I had a client where they discovered lots of arsenic in the soil and they had to have it removed. So all the owner's responsibility. And so the architect here makes it very clear. I'm not responsible for getting rid of the toxic waste on the site or in any of the equipment. 10.7. The architect shall have a right to include photographic or artistic representations of the project among their promotional and professional materials. And that makes sense. And, you know, I designed it, and I want to show everybody else what a good designer I am, so I'm going to put it in my brochures, and I'm allowed to. Now, depending on your owner, my project that I've been talking about, that we had the meeting with the board, the senior members last week, we revised this provision, and we said that the architect has to get authorization from the owner before they put them any pictures of the project in the architect's professional materials. Because this owner wants careful control of how they're brand and their business is displayed and advertised. And so they don't necessarily have a problem with the architect saying, oh, I did this building for X, but they want to make sure that it's within the taste and the parameters that the owner normally does, as opposed to the architect can just put it out wherever they want. And they don't want the architect to try to make money off the owner's name. It's a fairly well-known company. And so they want to say, look, we want to limit your rights to do that. 10.7, even though, so 10.7 continuing on in the back half of it, so while you can do photographic and artistic representations, the back half of the 10.7 says if there's confidential or proprietary information, they can't disclose that information. They can't give that out because it's all considered confidential. And the owner, and that's important because the owner, they're going to be giving financial information for the budget. There may be things about how the building operates that may be trade secrets. So there's lots of stuff that could be for the construction of a project that the owner doesn't want the public to know. So they may say, yes, you can put photographs, but no, you can't put this. And no, you can't give out this information. In fact, one of the other reasons why my client modified the first part of this provision is because any pictures of the interior of this facility potentially has intellectual property rights because the product they make is very secretive of how they do it. Their process is to them and them only. And so as a result, they don't want anybody to let this confidential information out. So, and then the final part of this, the owner shall provide professional credit for the architect on the owner's promotional materials. So sometimes this is allowed, sometimes it's not, but basically this what it says is that the owner on their website or their brochures had pictures of the project. Somewhere in there they would like the owner to say in the bottom, this was designed by, you know, whatever architects. That's what that says. 10.8. If the owner or architect receives information specifically designated by the other party as confidential or business proprietary, they need to keep that information strictly confidential. So, and they can't disclose it to anybody but their employees, those that need to know to perform the construction or consult. So obviously, you have to let your designers know and your subconsultants and the contractors, but if it says confidential or business proprietary, it must stay secret. And these are really important, often more for the owner than the contractor or the architect. But there may be some proprietary stuff that the architect provides, but more often favors the owner. Any question on additional miscellaneous terms? One thing you'll find under Article 10 is sometimes this will get expanded. I have 10.9, 10.10, 10.11. I have other provisions that I'll add in here that kind of don't fall under any other category. So this is one area where you'll see the contract maybe increase tied to specifics of the project. So for example, when I represent Navy Pier, and when Navy Pier did the revisions, the renovations, the owner did not want to do the geotech, largely because it's not a traditional site. Obviously, the pier sits out on the water, and it's built on pilings, and it's 100 years old, and lots of stuff that is very unique about it. And so they had obligations and responsibilities that the architect had to go out and hire its own team of engineers and surveyors and examiners to make sure that they understood the condition of the land, quote-unquote, the land or the pier on which the project was going to be built. And so there was a whole host of duties and obligations surrounding that additional work that normally is on the owner's side. There would be in a contract between the owner and the geotech or the surveyor or whomever. And that was all then looped in and put in, and we put it into Article 10. So we had to find a spot to put it, and we expanded Article 10 as miscellaneous provisions. Okay, compensation. So you've been doing all this work, you've got to figure out how to get paid. And there are different payment methods for the project, okay? So, for your basic services, and remember, basic services, architectural, structural, mechanical, electrical, you're going to be paid as follows. And here, you just put down how much the dollar is. It's the amount of, it may be a flat fee. I'm going to get paid $150,000 to design your million-dollar house. Or it may say, I'm going to get paid 10% of the cost of the work. It's a million-dollar house, you're going to pay me $100,000. Or it could be, I get paid hourly. So you're going to describe under 11.1, for my basic services, here's how I'm going to be paid. For additional services under 11.2, here's how I'm going to be paid. And it could be different. You could have in 11.1, I get paid $150,000 for my basic services, flat rate. 11.2, everything is going to be done on an hourly basis. Or it could be in 11.1, I'm going to be doing everything on a percentage. And in 11.2, you're going to say, these three additional services is a flat rate, and these four are going to be as a percentage, and these four are going to be hourly. So it's a mix or match. And when you go out and work in the field, and you'll talk to the companies that you work for, they're going to have what they believe are the best models on how to get paid. So that's why it just says insert amount or basis for compensation, because you're really not sure how that's going to be done. For additional services that arise during the course of the project, so that may come up later. So you may have in section 4.1 additional services that everybody agrees to the beginning. I'm going to do landscape design for you. That everybody knows from the very beginning. And for the landscape design services, you're going to pay me an additional $25,000. And then later in the project, maybe the landscape design services expand, or maybe in the middle of the project, you want to have some other type that you pull from the list of additional services. There's a whole, like I said, that laundry list that I talked about, that schedule. And so it may not have come up in the beginning, but it comes up in the middle. And so what you want to do when you're negotiating is you want to say, hey, let's figure out how to price that now. Most of the time, you're going to see an 11.3, that the additional services come up during the course of the project. Most of the time you're going to see this is going to be either percentage of, for the work, or hourly. I would say hourly is probably the most common. But you want to fill, you want to try to fill in this blank. You don't have to, but you might want to try to think about filling this blank so we know in the beginning what we're getting into in the middle. So that's how. So that's, these are architect's payments. 11.1, 11.2, 11.3. Now, 11.4 is when the architect has a consultant. The architect has that electrical engineer. The architect has the mechanical engineer. So for that, they get paid additional services of the consultants, not included in 11.2, 11.3, plus the percentage. So for that, it says, okay, I have to hire this consultant. I have to hire a specially low-voltage lighting designer. And they're going to charge me whatever they charge me. Maybe they're charging me hourly, maybe they're charging me a flat rate. So let's say that the cost is $10,000. But the architect says, I get those costs plus, and often this is a percentage, 10%. It's a markup. It's very common. Contractors do it all the time. They mark up their subcontractors and architects as well. I try to get, if I'm an owner, I try to get this to be zero. It's just a pass-through cost. But sometimes the architect will get anywhere between 0.5% and 15%. I'm sorry, 5% and 15% markup here. So if it's a $10,000 fee, the architect gets paid 11. They pass the 10,000 downstream to the low voltage designer, and the architect keeps the 1,000. So that's what 11.4 says. 11.5. This is where, if we go back to the previous page, hold on. If we go back to 11.1, and we say for the basic services, we're going to be paid, and let's say we put in a flat rate, $150,000. That's what you're paying me to design your million-dollar house. Flat rate, $150,000. It's not hourly, it's not percentage, it's just $150,000. But when does the owner pay that? How do we know to pay? So what we do for that is when it's based on a stipulated sum, flat rate, or even a percentage, when do we pay? Well, we have these phases. Remember the phases we talked about, the five phases here. Each one of those, you calculate as a percentage of the total work. So normally you're going to have schematic design is roughly 15, design development is 25, so now you're up to 40. Construction document phase is normally 40%, bidding negotiation maybe 5, and then construction phase leaves you down to the remaining 15, or however these percentages break out. And you'll know, you and your architectural firm will know that. So let's say, for ease of the discussion, your fee is $150,000. Let's say your schematic design phase was 10%. Well, at the end of your schematic design phase, you should be paid 15 grand. It's just simple math. And this is kind of, again, it helps the owner and the architect understand when the money's going to come, how is it going to be paid, and what it's going to be paid. And to think about it also, if you remember way back when we were talking about in Article 3, the schematic design phase, there was that process. I'm going to do these drawings, we're going to talk about it, I'm going to provide them for you, you're going to look at them, and then you're going to approve that I've completed the schematic design phase. I'm not going to go to the next phase of design development until I get owner's approval in writing that you're good with my schematic design. Well, that owner's approval in writing that we talked about way back in Article 3.3 or 3.2, whatever it is, once that approval in writing comes, that triggers that you get paid at this percentage, your $15,000, your 10% of the $150,000. So they're hand in glove. The architect wants approval to know that they can start working on the next phase. The architect also wants approval to know that that's when they get paid. Make sense? Okay. When the compensation is based on a percentage of the cost of the work, so I get paid, and that's another common way to do it, I get paid 10% of the cost of the work of the project. Any portions of the project that are deleted or otherwise not constructed, compensation for these portions of the project should be payable to the extent the services are performed on those portions. So let's talk about that. Let's see back here. So what this is saying is, I'm designing the $1 million house for you, and it's supposed to be on the cost of the work. We come in, and it comes in over budget. Well, I've designed. Do I get paid on the? Comes in at $1.1 million. Do I get paid on that? No. I get paid because we're not going to build it. It comes in too high. It's over budget. So now I have to redesign it. And it may bring down the cost of the work, but I've already worked on a portion of that. I should get paid for those services. So should we be payable to the extent the services are performed on those portions? So if you designed the $1.1 million house, you may have to redesign portions of it for free, but you still get paid for the work you've done to date. The owner can't say, I'm not paying you for the additional $100,000 worth of services. You have to be paid at least to date. And so that's going to kind of be, you're going to have to, again, when the bids come in, you're going to have to sit down with the owner and figure out. This provision rarely comes up where there's a discrepancy, where the budget is blown, and you're being asked to pay for the work you've done to date, even though you have to redesign for free. But it sometimes comes up. So they wanted to spell it out in the provisions to tell you how it works. Okay, so 7, that's 11.6. So if you remember 11.5 has this percentages when it's based on the stipulated sum. 11.7 says, if you're going to be doing this by hourly, so you're going to charge me hourly instead of by cost of the work, or by percentage or a lump sum, you got to put in your rates. So you stick in under 11.7 your rates. Senior designer, $350 an hour. The principal, $350. Senior designer, $275. Associates at $225, whatever it might be. So you put in your rates here, and you put that in the contract. Compensation for reimbursable expenses. So you're going to have expenses like transportation, long distance. So there's this list here under 11.8.1 of all these costs that you're going to incur during the course of the project that you're entitled to be paid for. So this may be, you get your basic services, and then you may get your reimbursable expenses, which is outside of the price for the basic services. Depends on how you negotiate. So there's 5 on this side, on this slide, And the next slide identifies another six more mock-ups, models. There's taxes, site office expenses. All of these are lists, and these can be changed and modified, but this is kind of your standard list of what would be deemed reimbursable expenses. And so they get the cost under 11.8.2, compensation for the expenses incurred by the architect, so the actual cost of these 11 items above, plus, and there's a blank, there would be a markup. Again, this markup is anywhere between 5% and 15%. Normally, more often than not, it falls in at a 10% markup. And the simple economic reason for that is if I have to go out and pay someone to build models or to get a professional photographer, I have to incur those costs, I pay for them, I bill them to you because I get those expenses, but I have a carrying cost. I have my time to make the phone calls to set up the appointments. I have all these other kind of hidden costs that aren't the architectural design. So those carrying costs that I have entitle me to the 10% markup. That's kind of the thought process there. 11.9, this is important. So let's say, if you remember, we talked about termination. And it says that if the owner terminates the architect for its convenience under 9.5, or the architect then terminates the agreement under 9.3, and 9.3 was where it was the suspension for longer than 90 days, the owner shall pay a licensing fee for compensation for the owner's continued use of the architect's instruments and services, and for solely for the purpose of completing, maintaining, using, and maintaining the project. So what this recognizes, and what this is a fair provision, is that for 9.5, the marriage may not have worked. And you don't want to have the owner start over from scratch. Again, too cost prohibitive to start from the very beginning. But it just doesn't make sense for the owner and the architect to continue to have a business relationship. And you don't want to get into litigation, so you don't want to terminate for cause. So you terminate for convenience under 9.5, and then you say to the architect, I've paid you for everything you've done to date. I will pay you for a licensing fee so I can continue to use it. And that's fair. Now, interestingly enough, though, remember, if the owner is building something and they're not using the architect, there's an argument to be made that the owner's continued use, that the architect would not be held liable for certain uses of those drawings. It depends on where they are in the process. So if this comes up, you either side, if you represent the architect, you have to negotiate on behalf of the architect's benefit, and the owner the other way. There may be the kind of get out of jail free card I talked about earlier in Article 7. But if the owner uses the drawings, even though they've paid the licensing fee, would the architect be able to be indemnified and not be held responsible if something goes wrong after the owner has terminated? And then the same thing under termination for suspension. Well, that's the 9.3. If the architect gets the right to terminate under suspension, the owner's like, well, wait a minute. I was just trying to get financing. I understand that your senior designer, she had this great project she wanted to go on. I'm really sad that you terminated me, but I can't stop you because the contract allows you to do that. But man, you've put me in really dire straits. Now I've got my financing, and I want the project to continue. If I can't use your drawings, I got to start over from scratch. So that's going to cost me tens of thousands of dollars, maybe millions. So this provision recognizes the other side. As long as the owner's paid its licensing fee, they get to be able to use the drawings as well. So it's trying to be fair for both parties in this situation. This is just talking about initial payment. There'll be a down payment made. Sometimes you want to seed money, start the project off. Very, very common to have an initial payment. And then 11.10.2 talks about you're going to be paid monthly on a monthly basis. This stuff will make a little bit more sense when we, in a later lecture after the break, we'll talk about how you operated a business and how much revenue you have to generate on a monthly basis. to keep your doors open and stuff like this. But obviously, you want to have all these things spelled out in the contract so that both parties know when payment's going to be made, how much, and for what reasons. So that's 1110.2. 1110.3. This is another very important provision for the architect. The owner shall not withhold amounts from the architect's compensation to impose a penalty or liquidated damages on the architect, or to offset funds requested to be paid the contractor for costs or changes in the work, unless the architect agrees or has been found liable for the amounts in a binding dispute resolution proceeding. So what does this mean? So, I've hired you to design that building for me, and you have the wall falls down, this example that I keep using. The contractor, so you, and the owner's like, was it built wrong? Was it designed wrong? I'm not sure. And it turns out that the time that it's going to cause to rebuild the wall is going to make the project delayed. So the contractor, it makes a claim, I should be paid, because it's a big wall, I should be paid $500,000 for building this wall. So that's the contractor's claim. The owner says, yeah, you were supposed to finish this project by August 1st, and now you're going to be delayed, so I'm going to charge liquidated damages against you, and there's going to be a fight over whether the owner's entitled to its damages coming back, so you owe me, you say you're owed $500,000 for the additional work, I'm saying you're going to owe me $1 million for liquidated damages. So that's a discussion that's ongoing between the contractor and the owner. At the end of the day, though, the architect or the owner may have to pay some money. And it may be due to the fault of the architect's design. The wall fall down. We don't know if it's the contractor or if it's the architect, but we think it may be the architect. What this provision says is, yes, you may have to pay the contractor $500,000 to rebuild that wall. But you cannot withhold what you owe me for my work to offset what you have to pay the contractor. We'll figure it out. If I'm liable, I have to pay you elsewhere, and I have insurance for that and everything else. But you can't say to me, I'm not making payment on your bill because your screw-up cost me $500,000. That's what this says. Except for, of course, the architect may agree, or if there's already been a mediation or arbitration. Sometimes you have, like for my long, long projects that last a couple years, if a dispute arises during the course of the project, we will try to resolve it real time as opposed to waiting to the end to finish things. And sometimes I've had decisions where a party has been found liable under an arbitration while the project is continuing. In that instance, the owner could then withhold the money from the architect. But any other instance, this provision says, if I did the work, you pay me. If I screwed up, well, we'll fight that out and pay another day, but you can't withhold this from me. So this is an important provision for the architect. As you might imagine, as the owner, I try to strike this, but it's still important, and you want to keep that in. Okay, any questions on compensation? All right. Special terms and conditions. This is an easy one. There's nothing here. This is anything else you want to add in. So when I represent an owner, I have like probably a dozen provisions that I stick in here that the contract doesn't address, and I stick them all in Article 12. It's different than the miscellaneous provisions that I talked about earlier, what we did for the Navy Pier project. These you could have put them here. It just depends, but this is kind of this is the catch-all. Anything that's not in this agreement, we left a blank for you, owner and architect, to fill in the blanks. And then Article 13, this just simply identifies what's the agreement. It's got the B101, it's got a couple other ones, this E201 digital data protocol, we talked about that earlier. References, there's the other provision, the other document, the sustainable exhibit, that would be also listed here. So anything that would be exhibits, a project schedule, for timing-wise, the rate sheet, anything else that's part of the agreement would be attached here. So, And that is it. All right. So, next week, exam. At 9 o'clock, or shortly before, I'll send an email to everybody. I'll need cameras and microphones on during the exam. And obviously, if you have questions, what I will need to do is, so if you have questions, you can, I'll be here. You can just send me a chat, like a you know, I have a question. And what I need to do between now and then is figure out how to do breakouts so we can have a separate conversation. But we'll do that if you really want to do a specific. Or if you have a question and you want to ask that you think that the whole class can hear, that's fine too. We can do it to everybody. That will be the process. Like I said, it's about 40 questions. Roughly between a third and a half, like, you know, probably a little over a third will be on this agreement. And open book, open note. That's it. Any questions?
Mike, I know you said you were going to upload the class recordings onto your website. Are those there now?
Have you guys looked? They should be. If they're not, I'll find out. I'll look after class and find out. They should have been put up.
Okay.
So.
No, I haven't checked it.
Okay. Yeah. They were supposed to. If they haven't, I will talk to them and get them up. And if they're not, and you want, obviously I have them all individually, you know, on my hard drive, on my C drive here for my own computer. If there's something you need before we get them up, if they're not up, just shoot me an email and say, and I'll just send them back to you. I'll send them to you guys.
So,
okay.
Michael, I have a question about, like, how the questions are going to be presented to us. Like, are they, like, fill in the blank, or are they questions, or are they mini essays, or?
So, the questions are, they're multiple choice. There's no fill in the blank. So you're going to have the exam, and then you'll have a separate like score sheet that's A through D. And so all you'll need to do is fill in the circles of the A through D. I haven't figured out how to like make the exam where you like to do a computerized or anything else, because I just have scanned in my exam from the past. So you'll just fill that in and you'll send that to me when you finish it. You'll send me a PDF of your exam. So what I would do is I would print it out. I will send you guys the night before just the answer sheet, so you can print that out, and then you can either scan it, send it back to me. You can take a picture with your phone and send it back to me. However, it's easiest to get me whether your answer sheet. That's all you have to send me back is the answer grid. The questions themselves will be, some will be a couple sentences. Some might be like a little mini fact scenario. There'll be three or four sentences, like a small paragraph. There's not going to be, you know, and it'll be like, I'm trying to think of one that I've used in the past. So you may have an example where owner and architect get into an agreement. The agreement is for X thousands of dollars. Such and such amount of work is performed. The owner has to bring in somebody else to complete the project. Which of the following would be how much is owed to the owner because they had to bring somebody else in due to the contract, the architect's breach? And so for that, you would have to say, okay, what are the dollar figures? You have to look at the facts in the little scenario of what the dollar figures are. And then you have to go back and you think to yourself, okay, there's a breach of contract. What's the remedy and how do we do the remedies? And if you remember, we in the remedies, the situation with remedies, we had, you know, we had restitution, we had expectation damages. So you have to kind of think about, okay, this is a damage question. Here's the numbers. Which theory do I use? And then there'll be 5,000, 10,000, 15,000, 20,000, whatever the numbers might be, and then that's your answer. And that's, and then you fill in that to blank. So that's the kind of scenario. I have to go back and look. I know I have in, I can't remember how I've set this up in the past. In the final exam, I have a couple of questions that are, I could probably turn off my microphone for this, just because we don't need this.